There's this kind of, and I hate to say it out loud, but there's this sort of like awe that I have for just the brazenness of someone to go like, oh, I just had a mob of my supporters storm the Capitol, hold up a legal proceeding, threaten the lives of people in my name. But you know what? Just give it a few years. I'll be all right. Like just the audacity somehow is
Oh,
just like this. It's amazing. I'm
it's
flabbergasted.
it is flabbergasting. Welcome to episode 291 of Pup Theology Live, a weekly conversation on life and faith over a craft brewed pint, a fine wine, or whatever happens to be in your glass. On today's episode, Reverend Ogun Holder and yours truly, Reverend Brian Berkoff, will address and engage what's happening through a theological lens with a good brew in hand.
And that good brew might be in your own Pub Theology Life pint glass, which you will receive as a thank you when you become a subscriber on Subscriber, I Can Talk, on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/PTLive to get some bonus content as well, pre and post show banter. And it helps keep podcasts going. And as always, we appreciate our current sponsors, our current patrons, sorry. So you could be one of them. Patreon.com/PTLive. And also, if you happen to be free July 11th through 14th, come on down to Wild Goose Festival, Van Hoy Farms, Union Grove. We will be recording, Shannon and I, and yet to be named guest. We will be recording a live episode at the Goose, as we have done the last few years. And if you use our special code A-SW24, you will get $50 off the price of your adult weekend ticket. That's A-SW24 for $50 off weekend ticket to the Wild Goose Festival. If you've never heard of it, it's a very fun, very progressive Christian/spiritual festival. Good things happen there. So check it out. Today on the pod, we are discussing church splits, campus protests, and theme songs. Those three things can all be related, I'm sure. And yeah, here we go. What are you drinking today?
Today I am drinking a tropical pineapple Kolsch beer by Rockwall Brewing out of Rochester, New York. So it's a nice, it's light, it's fruity, only 4.5%. So, you know, a good early afternoon brewski.
Yeah. Sounds like a tropical summery drink.
It kind of is. We don't quite have summer weather, but it's kind of rain and thunderstorms today. But you know what? Summer on the inside.
There you go.
What do you got, Ogun?
An oldie but a goodie, the Kronenbourg 1664.
Nice.
Blonde. Yeah. Yep. Got me a whole pint here, so.
Yeah, is that's German?
Go down and see. Yeah, yes it is. Have you never had one of these?
I have. I had one when I was in Europe a couple summers ago.
There you go.
I think
there we go.
Kronen's all like crown or like king, I think, in German. And Berg
I
is
have
like
no idea.
Mountain. So king of the mountain.
King of the mountain. King of the hill.
King of the hill.
Yeah. King of the hill.
Kronenberg.
On to today's topics.
All right. To set us off today, have you ever microwaved something and been surprised by the result?
Butter.
Ooh.
Thought about this. Like sometimes, you know, you take butter out of the fridge hard and you want to soften up a little bit. I did that in a microwave once. It didn't go well. what ended up happening was I ended up with three things going on. Still the really hard block of butter, then liquid butter, and then boiling butter at the edges.
Yes.
But nothing spreadable.
No, it just like instantly wants to like melt and get hot.
Yeah, it melts and boils. And yeah, so I was kind of like, all right. And interestingly enough, that set me on a little research project because I said, let me put it at low power. And you realize, did you know that in microwave, there really is no difference in the power that comes to the food? It's just one power. But what happens is when you do a low set in, it cycles the microwaves on and off. And varies that so it's not hit with the same amount of microwave energy.
It varies the pace or the amount.
It varies the pace, right. But it's you don't vary the intensity of the microwaves that hit the food. There's kind of apparently no way to do that. Wow. At least that was what my research told me some decades ago. So yeah, so that power set in is kind of just a little bit of a crock.
Yeah, I'll often do the lower power. Like if I'm defrosting something, you know, I don't want it full power. There you go.
Yeah. So that explains why, for me, the butter didn't soften because it's still getting the same intensity of microwaves. It just, it's getting it in spurts instead of like a constant thing. But yeah, so it's not like a stove where you can reduce the heat. You don't really reduce the heat.
Okay.
It's the difference between, like, you know, putting your hand on a hot stove intermittently versus planting your hand on the hot stove.
Big difference.
You're still getting burnt a little bit, and still the same amount of heat.
You're still getting burnt.
I don't know if that analogy holds up or not, but yeah.
So I've done one of those, you know, where you've got a plate or a cup that's got like metal flaking in the design. And then all of a sudden you got sparklers going off in the microwave because it's just.
Yes.
So I've done that before. I also read that if you cut a grape in half almost all the way, but then leave it connected on one end, if you microwave that for 5 seconds, it becomes a fireball.
Oh, really?
That's what I read. That's what kind of inspired the question. I remember I saw the article like, grapes and fireballs, so I don't know.
All right, I'll have to try that out.
So try at your own risk.
I think.
Right. We have some dishes, so like if you're heating up like tea or a cup of soup, where the dish seemingly takes all the power instead of the contents, and so like you'll have this bowl that's so hot to touch, and you're like, this has got to be way too hot to eat. And then you taste it and it's like, why is this still kind of lukewarm or even cold, but the dish is super hot? So I don't know why that is, but we have some dishes that seem to just absorb the microwaves instead of the food or the water. And that kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah. I don't remember. I'm not a big microwave user anymore in general, because it never does anything good to the food, in my opinion.
Well, there's that question too, know. Right? Like, what am I ingesting? Like, what have I just done to that food and now I'm consuming it?
Well, I wasn't even going there, but that's a good point too. But I mean, like, it never warms up food well, in my opinion. Like, you know, you stick pizza in the microwave, it doesn't come out well.
No.
Nothing seems to, and even like, you know, you put a plate of leftover food in your microwave to warm it up, there's always something on the plate that doesn't come out like texture wise or it just messes the food up in some way. So
right,
I mean,
yeah,
push comes to shove, if I got a plate of leftovers, I might do that, but
I'll do it for leftovers, for soup, again, heating up tea or cold coffee or whatever, that's fine. But if I'm doing something like a frozen burrito, my trick is, it's best if you just bake it in the oven, but if I don't have time for that, I'll microwave it for half the time and then pop it in the toaster. And then it sort of has that bakedness to it, but it got there quicker.
I've done that too. Yes. Like warm, because the inside will get warm.
Yep.
And then pop it in the toaster oven for a little bit. But, you know,
toaster dries it out, so it's not that smushiness.
But I think it's just another example of humanity's increasing impatience with itself.
Oh, yeah.
That we can't, like, you know, wait a little bit for an oven to warm up or, you know, something. So here in Morocco, I've learned how to really, I won't say cook because that's giving myself too much credit, but use a tagine. So the tagine is the traditional like Morocco dish that they cook in those clay containers.
Yeah.
And it's both the name of the meal and the dish and the actual clay container. And what you do is like you put the, you can do it on your stove. Originally, people would put them in like, you know, you start a fire somewhere and you sit this thing in the fire. You put the foods in the pot uncooked and you cover it. And it's a big, heavy clay dish shaped like this. So the bottom bowl's flat, top's like this. There's just a tiny little hole, you know, make sure air gets out and stuff. And you sit it on a hot surface, but it's a low heat and that thing slow cooks beautifully, right? So just this whole, so there's no Russian a tagine at all. And I'm staying in a apartment with my partner who doesn't have a microwave, so now if we want to reheat food, we put the tagine back on the stove. And you can't do a high heat, too high a heat will crack the clay. The clay's got to warm up. And right. It also retains the heat. So long after you turn the stove off, this thing stays warm and the food in it stays warm. But it takes a while. So there's no, I am hungry, I need food, warm food right now. Let me go fire up the tagine.
Right.
So you learn to be patient with the warm in this way. And it's always better for me than a microwave because it doesn't always, you know, the food always retains its moisture because it's this like self-contained like oven is what you end up
right
creating. It's pretty cool.
How do you spell pretty that?
T-A-G-I-N-E, tagine.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nice. I like that.
Very traditional. I don't think it's just Morocco, maybe Northern Africa. But yeah, so you know, people are trekking across the desert. They got the little clay pots and the jeans. You throw everything in, put some water, put the lid on, throw it in the fire. Let the clay do the cooking.
There you go. I love it. All right. So last week, the United Methodist Church made a big step. They removed the last barriers to full inclusion and equality of LGBTQ+ members in the life of the church. Though, you know, and some will say, well, it took a while to get here. Also, it took nearly a quarter of UMC churches to leave the denomination over the last 5 years. 7,600 churches left the UMC and, primarily, as I understand it, over this issue. And so the vote now with who's left was, okay, let's move forward toward inclusion. And so wondering what you think about the reality that it took losing, you know, thousands of churches to come to this decision. And is it better for churches that disagree on issues like this to separate, or would it be better to try to work toward unity and staying together despite differences, whether it's on this or on other things?
Unity in churches. Have you ever met churches? That's not a thing. I think this was a good move. And what's interesting is that the churches that left were those who wanted to uphold the traditional doctrine of homosexuality being inherently a sin, therefore, you know, we won't have any queer clergy or sanctioned queer marriages or anything like that. Yeah. You know, and people attend in those churches. I mean, it was fine for queer folk to attend church, but there was still always that, like, you're here, but, you know, you still sit in.
You're second class.
Exactly. So I think we are very clear where the right side of this argument is, where the right side of history on this is, right? So good for them for being willing to lose those members. Because that's the other thing about churches and movements and denominations. They're very reluctant to lose people, right? Strength in numbers, money in numbers.
Losing money.
All the things, right? I don't remember if the churches that left, were they allowed to like basically take their properties or stuff like that with them? I don't remember all the details.
I'm not sure where the United Methodist Church is on that. If the individual church owns the building, I think sometimes they don't. And it's like the larger conference that owns it, but I'm not sure how.
Right.
They may have, I feel like they also may have found a way around that because that's usually a key thing.
Yeah. I think they allowed the church, if the conference owned the church, I think they allowed the church to hang on to the property. And I could be wrong about that, but if that's what happened in some cases, then yes, that's a major financial hit to a denomination, right? But good for them for saying, no, the people are more important than the property, right? And we are very clear that not just public and cultural sentiment has shifted on this, but theology has shifted on this as well. So, yeah, unfortunately, the larger global Methodist movement, you know, a lot of the churches, especially in African countries where, and not just African countries, but I'm using them as an example where, you know, homosexuality is still illegal. They're still like, no, we're not going to change this. So it's a good move, and good for them for doing it, and good for them for taking that, I guess, practicing what they preach, right? Because if we say God is love and God loves all of God's creation, then we kind of got to walk or talk here.
No doubt. You and I, obviously, and Shannon are all in full agreement of this move and of this stance, and lead churches that express that and practice that, or have led churches that lead and practice full welcome and inclusion for all God's children. And so I think on this issue, I think if you're going to insist, no, folks aren't welcome here because of their orientation or identity, then yeah, you can take that view and form your own little thing. So I agree with you that in this instance, on this topic, that it's just hard to coexist with such radically different views on something that's core about people, about human beings. You know, this isn't just like, well, what's your view on baptism or what really happens in the Lord's Supper? Like, that feels a little more esoteric, and you're not sort of reclassifying human beings as inherently, you know, good or bad or in sin or not in sin. And so on those issues, you know, on things that aren't about that, I think trying to find unity and ways to coexist despite difference can be good. We don't want to just keep shrinking a bubble smaller and smaller to people we only agree with on everything, though sometimes we tend to do that. But I think being in relationship with people who think a little bit different than I do is on the whole a good thing. But on this issue, it just doesn't work, as they found out.
Right.
So I think the churches that left are happier and the churches that remained are happier. And I guess that's a win-win.
I think we'll get to that point eventually. But I think for right now, there's celebration. But at the same time, it came at arguably a cost to the movement and the denomination as a whole, that they weren't able to come to a mutual agreement on this. And sometimes, I mean, that's what happens in relationships. You get to a point where, you know, we have to agree to disagree and go our separate ways. And I have to give credit, which was kind of, I think, alluding to your question, to the people who, before the split, stayed in the denomination in an effort to try and shift the thinking around this. And that's always a question, right? Do I stay and try to change the movement that I love, or do I go where I'm welcomed and, you know, preserve my sanity and my, you know, self-care and all that sort of thing? And there's it's a both and. For some people, it's more important to fight the good fight and try to usher in reformation and transformation, and they have the energy and the willpower to do that. And for other people, life is just too damn short and want to be happy. let me go somewhere where I am welcomed, and not just welcomed. Let me go somewhere where I am acknowledged for who I am.
Yeah. Celebrated, not just tolerated.
Right. And, you know, I'm not being told that there's something inherently wrong with who I am. So there's no wrong answers here. I've tended to do the former, no, the latter, which is to go hightail it out of town. And right now I feel like I am, when it comes to my own denomination, Unity, I'm kind of halfway in between. I'm like one foot's out the door, but one foot's still making trouble and, you know, making noise, but not wholly invested in trying to, you know, bring some kind of transformation, because again, life is short. And as I am on the brink of turning 50, and I go like, all right, how do I want to spend the at best, or hopefully, fingers crossed, next 25, 30 years of my life? Like, do I want to spend it trying to reform and transform people that may not want to change?
No doubt.
And, you know, knowing that it's also okay if I go. So, that's never an easy answer. But I forget what the saying is that, like, if your belief requires you to think of me as less than, you know, a full human, then it's time to look at your beliefs. And I think,
right,
you know, I'm badly paraphrasing the exact saying, but
no, I got you. I'm tracking.
But
you know, it was similar for me in the denomination that I grew up in and then was ordained in and served for a decade or so in, and just came to a point where do I stay and work for change, or do I go somewhere where the movement's already moving, like things are already, I'll have institutional support to say and do and be the kind of things I want to say, do and be. And after 10 years of pushing for change, you just realize, for me, I came to a point where change ain't happening here in the next 10, 20, 50, maybe the rest of my life. It's not worth my energy to sit there and spin my wheels in the mud when I can go somewhere, not deal with that drama, and simply be authentically me, lead the kind of community I want to lead, and not apologize for it. And it was one of the best decisions I've ever made.
And again, for some people, that's really hard when, you know, for example, you may have attended a church where, in spite of the, you know, what the doctrine says, maybe outright, you know, anti-queer hostility was not practicing, actually felt a sense of belonging, you had friends, all the things. And then it's like, it's hard.
It's always complicated.
It always is. So just to acknowledge that and name that, and also to, you know, it brings to mind that ridiculous saying, hate, love the sinner, hate the sin, or whatever. Yeah. Whatever that saying is, you know, which
it.
Is, yeah, which I, you know, I really look forward to the day when the people who say that realize that there's no distinction there. Right. You know?
Yeah.
And again, that flawed premise that who I am is a choice. You're basically saying who I am is a choice and that I've chose wrong. So basically you're saying who I am is wrong. And, It's to put theology or belief system over acceptance and belonging, feels harsh. I think sometimes we all do it to some extent, right? Because, I mean, I don't know how much belonging I will extend to, you know, the most diehard of MAGA supporters, but,
right,
you know, but again, if your belief is infringing upon my liberation, then yes, we will have issues. So yeah, so it's I'm not gonna sit here, you know, trying to convey the idea that it's something I have mastered by any stretch of the imagination. No, I will. There will always be others. There will always be an othering, and I guess the paradox is to realize that while there's always an othering, there really is no other. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. All right. So there are protests happening on university campuses across the United States, across the world, in solidarity with Gaza. And many young protesters have spoken of the U.S.-enabled genocide in Gaza as the moral issue of our age. A lot of our media coverage of this seems to cast the students, mainly peaceful protesters, as having ill intentions, accusing them of using hate speech and hate symbols, in the words of the U.S. president, endorsing terrorism, advocating for Israel destruction, resorting to anti-Semitic slurs, and threatening and frightening Jewish students. So are you more inclined, I can guess, to be sympathetic toward the students and their cause, or do you think they've gone too far?
So when I think of this answer, I think of the bell curve. Remember the bell curve? Mm-hmm. Most of what's under a bell curve is centered in the middle areas. And yes, and then you have the extremes, right?
Right.
So are there extremes? Yes, there are extremes of people who are, veering into anti-Semitism, who are veering into harassing, you know, Jewish students. Like we have reports of that. However, like, what is that? Like 2% of what's happening? Like it's very minimal, especially with these protest. What's fascinating is I love seeing the reports, like the police have showed up, they're like harassing people and detaining, arresting, even being violent towards people who happen to be Jewish protesters also in solidarity with this movement.
Right.
Right. So it's like, yeah, you can't accuse these people of being anti-Semitic when there's Jews among them who are, you know, who are anti-Zionist Jews who are saying like, yeah, this has gone too far. One of the interesting things the president said was that we're not talking enough about Hamas's raid that resulted in the death of like almost 1,200 Israelis, went biblical on you there for a second.
You went biblical.
Israelis. and he's like, you're basically insinuating that we've forgotten about that. Well, I mean, yeah, because the response is not that we've forgotten about it, because when it happened, we were all like, holy crap, that's horrible.
Right.
And then we knew Israel would respond. We didn't fathom, and, you know, Hamas probably did. We didn't fathom that it would be this level of disproportionate response. So now it's like, no, we didn't forget that, nor are we condoning that, nor are we saying that that was okay.
Right.
We can disagree with, you know, Hamas going in and doing what they did. And we can also say that, well, that was horrible. This is so much worse. And it's
Bingo.
Both things are true.
Yes, both things can be true. Like, that's what drives me crazy on this whole thing. It's like, as soon as you speak out against what Israel is doing, it's, oh, you're anti-Semitic. Oh, you don't care about Hamas. Or, oh, you're enabling Hamas, even by taking that view. It's like, no, 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 no. I support Israel. I support Palestinians. And I don't support either of them killing each other. And I certainly don't support a completely disproportionate response to what was horrific, but now you're going to do 10 times that in response. More than 10. I mean, I don't even know.
More
than 40 times.
We had 30 plus times. At this point. And again, we also have to remember, and this is what I, if I was in a room with the president, to say, like, this did not occur within a vacuum. It's not like there was this harmonious, peaceful situation.
Correct.
And it just all went to hell, right? I mean, that beer. it was an apartheid state that the Palestinians were living in before.
For decades. Right?
For decades. So in many ways, it's like, no, I don't agree with what Hamas did. And at the same time, I'm not surprised that it happened. You can only exert pressure, that kind of horrific pressure on people for so long before they retaliate. And we've seen this throughout the course of history of all peoples. We saw this in South Africa with apartheid. We saw this in the US with the civil rights movement. Like, you can only handle that sort of oppression for so long before there's retaliation. Now, we can argue, yes, that retaliation, especially on October 7th, was not the right retaliation. That in itself was wrong.
Yes.
To, you know, suddenly roll in to Israel and kill almost 1,200 people, the vast majority of them non-combatants, innocents, right? Horrific, absolutely horrific. And Israel's response, like we mentioned, just so much more outlandishly horrific. That, because again, when Israel responded, if you remember, the public sentiment didn't get into this outrage until those numbers really started climbing,
right?
So Hamas did what they did. Everyone's like, oh my God, that's horrible. Not surprising, but horrible. And then Israel retaliated and they're like, all right, Israel has the right to defend itself. We understand that's a thing. But then they kept going and kept going. And that death toll number kept climbing. And like, the whole place is now pretty much flattened. And it's like, okay, like, whoa, that went way too far, you know?
Yes.
So,
yeah. You'll have, like you said, on the bell curve, you'll have a couple of extreme examples of students who unfortunately resorted to violence in their protest, but that's the tiny minority of students. These are by and large peaceful protests who are pleading with our government, stop funding a genocide, stop sending weapons, stop enabling, stop supporting this horrific thing in our name. Like, it just, that's why there's Jewish students out there too, who are like, not in our name. Like, this is wrong. What the Israeli government and military are doing.
And the protests are specifically mainly around students saying to the university, like, If you part of your investments to grow your endowment is connected to Israel, we want you to divest from those. Yes. By the way, we don't even know if you are, because you set up this wall of secrecy around how you fund your endowments. So, by the way, we'd like some transparency around that, which I don't think is an unfair ask to go like, show us how you get your money. By the way, some of these Ivy League schools that have billions of dollars, hundreds of millions to billions in an endowment, why are students still paying all the tuition they're paying? I'm just putting that out there.
Just saying.
Just saying. Just saying. But we also have to remember student protests, a well and storied part of Americana, right?
Yes.
So
fully within their rights, part of the great tradition yeah. in our democracy is your freedom of speech, freedom to protest injustice, do so in a peaceful manner, etc. And what I don't like is too many of our politicians are with a broad brush just painting all these students with the worst of what the super teeniest minority have done and just saying, well, that's all of them. No,
yes,
false. You are lying. That is not what's happening.
And I think I mentioned this last week. I don't remember if it was in the body of the show or pre or post, but kudos to the Washington, D.C. department. Yeah, it was in the body of the show.
It was.
Who, when George Washington University said, come clear a campus, they're like, no, we're not coming, because they pitched some tents and they're peacefully protesting. No, we're there's no reason for us to clear them. And one of the things we forget about protests is that the point of a protest is disruption, because it is the disruption that inconveniences the rest of the people around that make them go like, all right, you know, so like protesters block the freeway. Now I can't get to work. Now I'm annoyed, super annoyed that I can't get to work, or I can't pick up my child from daycare, or I can't go do what I was doing. This is super annoying. Why are they blocking the highway? Right. So then you begin to ask questions, inquiry arises. And maybe then you go like, oh, I didn't even know this was a thing. Let me investigate. Maybe let me take action. Maybe let me form solidarity or not. The point is inconvenience. The point is not violence. And again,
right.
99% of these are nonviolent protests. So to call in law enforcement for something that doesn't need enforcing was a little bit mystifying for me. So what was the inconvenience that instead of cutting across campus, you now got to take a more circuitous route when you were walking or the students aren't showing up to class, or like, I don't understand what was the disruption that in the case of the peaceful protests warranted the calls for law enforcement. And the truth is that they weren't. It was just like some universities, I think, felt like to allow them to continue to exist in this manner is given tacit support to their cause.
Yeah.
And we can't afford to do that. There was political pressure applied in some cases. You know, shout out to, I think it was Brown and a couple who were like, oh, you just want us to have a discussion and to divest? Well, you know, we got a, you know, meeting of boards and supervisors, whatever, coming up. Sure, we'll put it to a vote, see what they say. And students were like, okay, good. That's all we asked for. We're going to clear out. Now, if they vote no and they come back, that's a whole different story. But if your first resort is to just call the police, it's not a good look. It's wrong. New York has just been embarrassing itself. The reports of the guy on TV, one of the police commissioners something on TV, holding up this chain and a bike lock, saying like, you know, this is what they're using to barricade doors, and this is a sign that they're outside agitators influencing them. And people are like, dude, it's a New York bike lock. And my favorite part of it was, I was watching Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, and he's like, not only is this part of just being in New York, the university actually sells these on their website. They sell chains and bike locks on their website for students to purchase. So I'm like, and he's like, this is not what students usually walk to campus. Of course it is. I mean, like, how out of touch are you?
Right.
It was just infuriating to watch. And, you know, it's over the last couple of years, I used to be very much obsessed with watching the news all the time. So like, you know, I have like CNN on in the background or something when I'm just doing my stuff, like always in the news bubble. And the more I read about the media bias, I remember initially going like, no, I think, you know, yes, you got your Fox News all the way to the right. You got your MSNBC all the way to the left, but you have more of these like closer to center sort of places, still progressive leaning, that I can get on board with and not pull my hair out. But more and more, you know, yeah, I'm realizing, no, they're kind of all the same to some extent. Like you read what is being written about or said in places in like, you know, US mainstream media versus what's written in Al Jazeera. Like it's a whole different sentiment.
It's a whole different sentiment. Like MSNBC, some of their shows and hosts have just been disparaging the students, sort of like sounding like they're Fox News. And it's like,
yeah,
what are you doing? What are you doing?
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, I'm like, if you're not reading news sources from outside the US, you really probably should.
You're missing out.
And it says something that Israel just recently went like, all right, Al Jazeera, you got to get out and shut down their offices. Right. Because, you know, when you start silencing dissenting voices, those voices are probably saying something that needs to be heard. And it's not a good look for you either.
Right. Exactly. So my son was at the University of Michigan's graduation ceremony over the weekend in Ann Arbor. It was outdoors at Michigan Stadium. And he said, a friend was graduating. And he said there was a plane that flew over with one of those banners behind it. And it was like, we support Israel, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was a plane flying in the opposite direction that was, we support Palestine, divest from Israel now, or, you know, something like that. So there were these two planes like circling the stadium with like the opposite banner, but there was not a problem. And then there were students during the ceremony who kind of came prepared to like put up some Palestinian flags to do a chant, but it was all peaceful. You know, was there a little disruption to the proceedings? Yeah, but no one was out of line. It was handled, I think, appropriately from what I understand. And a message was sent, even at that moment, you know? And I think that's what it should be like.
Yes. Yes, it should be. There's a great, I listened to, what's her name? Audie Cornish. She used to be NPR.
Yeah.
Longstanding. Now she's got her own podcast for CNN. The name escapes me right now. But she recently interviewed both a student protester and president of a university. And this was, I think, a university that did not call the police. But he was talking about, absolutely, he felt the pressure to, and he goes, and if things get beyond them just being intense and chanting, absolutely he will. But right now they're just intense chanting and singing. And, you know, he goes, there's no reason for us to call the police. Right. This is kind of what we educate our students to do.
Yes.
And he mentioned how he was given an address at some point, and there were students up in the balcony, and they unfurled a banner. So like they were at the railing, they unfurled, you know, a banner, pro-Palestinian banner. And he did not have them kicked out or anything. And he plainly said, I was fine with that. They unfurled the banner and they just stood there with their banner. If they had started like shouting and yelling to the point where the proceedings could not progress, then yes, that's a level of disruption that he goes, I wouldn't tolerate. But I didn't feel the need to throw them out for just standing there with a banner. And he himself drew attention to it and said, we have some students up in the balcony protesting, as is their right, and we welcome them to the space. He said afterwards, a parent who was Jewish pulled him aside. It was so offensive that she couldn't stay and she had to leave. And I think this was a parent that might have been checking the place out to see if what her kid would attend or something. And the college president said, then this might not be the place for you and your son, because, you know, we advocate students being in action for their causes. Being violent, no, but disruptive action and protest and drawing attention to causes. Absolutely. And we've done this. You did it for Vietnam, did it for, again, apartheid in South Africa, like
civil rights.
I mean, civil rights. Good for these students, you know, for these Gen Zers bucking the narrative that they're just lazy kids who want a handout, right?
Right. That they're just apathetic.
Yeah. Exactly. And it would be interesting to see how many of their parents who may have been college students protesting Vietnam or stuff like that, how many of them are supporting their grandkids, at this point, or are objecting to them. That would be an interesting poll to take.
That would be really interesting. And I think, ironically, I think we'd be saddened at the results, because too often it's like with age and it's like, oh, you know, you just need to, you know, be quiet, get in line, blah, blah, blah. It'd be interesting.
And punishing the kids by, you know, withholding scholarships or expelling them from school. Again, if they were violent and harmed other people, you know, absolutely. Yeah.
But then legal consequences as appropriate.
Yes, exactly. But if you were just in peaceful protest and the university calls the police on you, and then now you have an arrest record and you can't be a student here, I'm like, you set them up for that. No, that's not okay. You know, and good things come from protests. The whole, you know, we talked earlier about the Methodist Church, right? The whole Protestant movement started as a protest.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't we support it?
Exactly. Yeah. So Ecclesiastes 8:11 has an interesting thought here. It says, when the sentence for a crime is not quickly carried out, people's hearts are filled with schemes to do wrong. In other words, you gotta figure out what the sentence is and then carry it out right away. Otherwise, people will just keep doing wrong things. This sounds like this could be like a motto at a police station or something. Right? Or in a courthouse or something. I don't know. I don't love this verse.
I want to go back to Ecclesiate, and I will say Ecclesi drank and Ecclesi had a good time. There you go.
It ain't easy being Ecclesi.
Nice. There you go. I don't like this verse either. This is so reactionary.
Well, right? it just smacks of, if we don't punish them right away, they'll keep being bad people. You know, it's like a parent. Like, if I let the kid get away with that, then all hell will break loose and I'll regret I didn't have a firm hand and I didn't draw the line. I didn't give consequences. I mean, it's cringe. I actually
liked giving the kid a few days of squirming, thinking about how I was going to punish her. Like,
right.
Like when they know the messed up and it's like, you know what? I mean, you sit there, let me think about what's going to happen next. And that time just drags on. Like, to see them squirm, I think that was more fun.
and that's more effective. And then they are owning their own remorse for what they did. Whereas if you're just always like reacting, or if you're reacting out of anger, that's never good. Like, that's just gonna like further, you know, divide that relationship, further make the person want to do it again, frankly.
So Viktor Frankl, and I use this quote recently, said, between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response is where we find our growth. Paraphrase a little badly. But how we...
Say the last part again.
Where we choose our response. In that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom.
Yeah.
So as much as the stimulus or the crime says about someone, how we respond says a lot about us as well. Looking at you, Israel. So, right? So it's like, yeah, how, but we need to give ourselves a space, Because often when we react right in the moment, we are reacting from our own pain, our own trigger, our own trauma. We might be reacting from misinformation, not the correct information. Like, take a beat to sort out what really happened. Take a beat to sort out what is the appropriate response, consequence, you know, punishments, if needs be. You can't do it in the moment with a hot head.
You look at the U.S. response to 9/11. Oh, you killed 3,000 of us. We'll see you and raise you to 100,000. You know, it's like absurd.
Right, right. Exactly. Now, conversely, sometimes the wheels of justice do take a long time to turn. Right. Like,
wow.
You know,
you're right. You got me, because in court today, Stormy Daniels is taking the stand, and we've got multiple trials against a certain former president where the sentence isn't being carried out quick enough. And he thinks,
right,
you know what? I can do no wrong.
Whose whole legal strategy was like, let's see how long we can delay this in the hope that I get into office, because no one's prosecuting a sitting president. And I'm getting into office, and then we're going to, you know, try to enact Project 2025 and keep me in office. So therefore, I'm good to go.
You're right. So, I retract everything. I now love this verse.
So, oh my gosh. I think again, you know, it's the both and. Don't like react right in the moment, but also don't drag this thing out to infinity, because right, then that's almost a condoning of what happened. So be mindful, but move your feet. move your feet.
Yeah.
Move mindfully. I like, you know, it's very clear when he called up, you know, the folks in Georgia and said, find me these votes.
Oh my God.
That, right? I don't think it should have taken 3 years.
No.
To have a trial about that. That feels really long, is all I'm saying.
Well, and the current trial is from the 2016 election. That's eight years. Like,
yes,
way too
exactly
long.
Exactly. So it's, you know, and of course, you know, you were kind of being humorous about it, but yeah, we like this verse when it works in our favor. We don't when it doesn't. That's pretty much with anything else, right?
Kind of how it goes with
that's good. That exactly. So again, where do we middle ground this? Where do we, you know, and it may seem a weird thing to say, but I think, not to contradict myself, but I think the severity of the crime needs more time to really figure out, you know, what happened here. And let's truly investigate this, because the more severe a crime, generally the more severe the punishment, the consequence.
Right.
And I don't think we should unfairly lay such a heavy punishment consequence on someone, especially if it ended up not have been the one to commit the crime. I mean, if the evidence is 100% clear and you have a recording of a phone call, well, that's different.
Right. We don't want to go back to the days where you put someone in the gallows or chop their head off the next day.
Exactly. Right. We don't need mob justice. We don't need a kangaroo court.
Right.
But we also don't need 3 years to go by when we have an audio recording of someone trying to commit election fraud. Like, exactly. I feel there's a middle ground in there somewhere. Like, this could have come out like a year and a half ago, maybe, and give us a little bit more of a buffer. But I think part of it, honestly, was, you know, I think when he lost the election, I think people thought he would have just gone away and we'd have been done with him. I don't think, especially after January 6th, people thought, like, this dude's going to ever get enough support to run for president again. And I'm like, have you not learned anything from him. Yeah, there's this kind of, and I hate to say it out loud, but there's this sort of like awe that I have for just the brazenness of someone to go like, oh, I just had a mob of my supporters storm the Capitol, hold up a legal proceeding, threaten the lives of people in my name. But you know what? Just give it a few years. I'll be all right. Like, just the audacity somehow is, I don't admire it, but I have to stand in like, just like awe of it.
Oh,
just like, this is amazing. Just, it's I'm flabbergasted.
It is flabbergasting. It is. Ugh. All right. Moving to our final topic on worship songs, praise songs. How Great Is Our God has long been one of the most popular worship songs in Christian churches. But since 2020, it's also become a theme song for Christian nationalist protesters. How Great Is Our God was sung by protesters during their Jericho marches that preceded the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. And does that mean they were going around it seven times and hoping the Capitol would fall down?
What happened to tear down these walls? That's a OG right. Praise and worship standard. Yeah,
there you go.
Definitely more Jericho-ish.
So they were singing it at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. It's been a staple at Christian nationalism conferences. And last week, MAGA activist and worship leader Sean Fucht stood at the gates of Columbia University to oppose pro-Palestinian protesters, of course, and to demand that the school's president resign. This song was on his lips. So why this song? Like, how great is our God? Like, is it like our Christian nationalist God? Is that just sort of assumed? Like, because I've sung this, you know, not recently, but I remember singing this in the past and not hating it. But now I don't like it. Now that I hear this, is the folks who are like, yeah, this is, how great is our God? Down with democracy.
Well, I don't know what to tell you, man. Like, I don't like to use the word crazy a lot, but these Christian nationalist folks, this is straight up crazy.
I got to look up the lyrics.
Bucket of crazy. I haven't sung it in a few decades either, but yes, I also do remember singing the song. But again, when your narrative is this is a Christian nation, and therefore as a Christian nation, here are the rules and tenets that everybody needs to be living by, and the people making these rules and the people in authority also need to be Christian. If that's your narrative, then yes, you believe that you're being divinely mandated to do this stuff. And the truth is, anybody can believe that God's telling them anything. Like, that's just, you know, religion 101, cult 101, like just everything 101. Like, if you believe that God's telling you to do a thing, then, you know, sing all the songs you want. But again, it's given religion a bad name. It's given Christianity a bad name. It's given God a bad name. If God, like at this point, if God were a being that could intervene and is not intervening with people giving God this name, then, you know, if you weren't done with God before now, you kind of have to be.
I want to rethink that interventionist theology.
Right? Exactly.
Seriously.
Exactly.
Seriously.
Oh, did you find the lyrics?
I did, but there's like nothing like that really stands out, you know. He wraps himself in light and darkness tries to hide and trembles at his voice. Age to age he stands and time is in his hands, beginning and the end. And then the chorus, how great is our God? Sing with me, how great. You know, I mean, it's kind of vanilla standard song, but I think it's the how great, like, kind of like make America great again. It's this sort of U.S. Preoccupation with U.S. exceptionalism, right? That we are the best. We are the greatest. We have the greatest God. We have the greatest country, whatever. And don't forget that God is on our side and he's making our country great. And so we're going to take it back for that great God or something.
Yeah. And not just American exceptionalism, but in some cases, Christian exceptionalism.
The
100%. Christianity is...
They go together.
The only right religion. Exactly. You know, so it, and I think in some ways my guess is singing sounds like these makes it a little more benign, right? Because this is a song that's being sung in a church that people, many millions of people go to in churches. And we're singing it out here. So it's proven that we are the good Christian folk. We are the people, God is on our side. We're singing this song. You know this song. Bad people don't sing this song.
Yeah, Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi would never sing this song.
Right, exactly. No, she'll just go down on one knee with kente cloth, which let's try to forget that ever happened. But
moving on.
Sometimes they don't do themselves any favors either. Let's just call it what it is. Okay.
Fair.
I don't mean a both sides of thing, but
all right. Is there a worship song or hymn that you used to like other than this one that now makes you shudder a little bit?
All of them. All of them. That's all I gotta say.
All of them, he says.
All of them. So you remember a few years ago when we went to Wild Goose and Amy Grant was there?
Yeah.
As a featured singer. And do you remember me being there and like as things were picking up with the songs and people were getting into it, and I'm like, I'm feeling so triggered right now, I have to go. Like it was
I remember that.
Bring me back to those days. Yeah. I mean, for me, all of these praise and worship songs removed my agency. They were given God control of everything. Yeah. They were basically saying, I can't make a decision for myself. I'm dependent on you, God. And basically I'm surrendering all my agency to you and you, God, but also by extension, you know, the religious authority, the pastor, the whoever, you know, the doctrines and the credos of the movement. I'm surrendering my agency to that.
And a lot of them have a groveling tone, you know, like, God, you're so great. I'm so not worthy, blah, blah, blah.
Worship. Praise and worship. It's in the name, man. Praise and worship.
It's in the name.
So real quick, I'm watching. Have you heard of the show Couples Therapy? It's on Showtime, but it's basically this therapist in New York. And she's doing sessions with couples, like real life couples. So it's not a reality show. It is like real TV, real people.
Oh, really?
Real sessions, real therapists, real couples. Right.
Okay.
And there's cameras in the room. There's not a camera crew. So there's no crew with cameras. They're just these like, you know, hidden cameras. You don't even see the cameras, but they're recording these sessions.
That helps people be honest, right?
Yes, exactly. And so people are working through their stuff. And there's this couple that got married when they were like, I don't know, 18 years old, that grew up in the Mormon church. And so they've come full circle. They've left the church. She left the church first. He stayed for a few more years. She wasn't happy about that. Like they had an open marriage. They've done all, I mean, they ran the gamut of what you could do along the lines of both deconstructing and finding themselves. But one of the stickler points that they were having was at one point, you know, when they were like experimenting with opening up their marriage, he was like, I'm good with this, but there's this one person that I don't want you to do it with. So he laid down this like, you know, this boundary here. He's like, and sure enough, she cheated on him with that person. And, you know, so they were working to get through that. And he said to her, like, all I want you to do is to, like, promise me, make a commitment that you would not hurt me like that again. And she couldn't do it. So they were arguing back and forth. It's like, wait, what is your trouble? Her thing was having an issue with the word commitment, because she said, this is what I did in church. I made a commitment to follow the rules of the church, to follow what the head of the church said, to follow what the lay leader said. I made all these commitments and I was so hurt and so wounded and
he was abused
and so made right to feel less than that. Every time I hear that word now, I'm like I found a sense of freedom in myself that I will never commit myself to somebody else to that degree. And when you're asking that from me, that's what it sounds like. And when she said that, then he was like, oh, I get it now, but that's not what I'm asking. So he was more able to articulate what he meant by that word. But this is what this kind of thing does to you, right? When religion takes away your agency rather than fortifying it, then you lose yourself in such a way that it is so hard to find yourself again.
Yeah.
You know, when you've been brought up, and I'll throw myself on the bus, when I was brought up to not be able to trust that I could make a decision unless I had some sort of divine sign or I prayed about it or that I needed approval from God through whoever else. Like, I mean, it decades literally as an adult before I could learn, even to this day, you know, the hard wiring is still back there that when I have to make a decision, like, the doubt arises and I got to go, what am I doing? I'm a rational human being. I know about pros and cons. I know about risk. I don't need some outside force to give me a sign as to if something is the right choice or not. But this is one of the dangers of when we just do, what's the word? Obeisance. What's the word I'm thinking of? Comes from obeying. When we get in that place of just going like, I am not worthy to have control over my life. I have to turn it over to God. Yeah. I have to turn it over to whatever. Yeah, your agency is being removed, and churches prey on that. They exploit that consciously and unconsciously.
So true. I think that's right. And I think often you can get, you know, these songs often have a simple tune, a repetitive lyric, and then you sort of get yourself like lost in it, right? And so people suddenly find themselves just like, okay, whatever you ask, I'm ready to do, because I'm emotionally caught up in this. There's a group, there's issues in my life that are tough and hard, but I'm finding something here that's connection, that says I'm okay. So whatever you ask for, I'm ready to give it. You know, it sets it up for that. And then sets it up for to be abused.
Yeah. And that's the power of song and music, right? It's when I was a music therapy student or professor, when we would say things like music is a universal language, he would go, no. Music is not a universal language, because there are some cultures who you hear their music, it will make absolutely no sense to you. But music is universal in that music unites us, right? Music creates community, a sense of belonging. Music touches us in places that words can't, right? It goes beyond the intellect. So this is sort of the power of song. And when you can, that's why, you know, churches, protest groups, people who go to marches, they sing chants, because there's something unifying and empowering and engaging about it. And when you can harness that, right, for ill gain, whether you think it's ill gain or not, when you harness it for ill gain, then you've got the people in the palm of your hands. I don't know about your church, but at my church, I mean, going all the way back to Barbados and our 3-hour church services, you know, an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours of that time was singing some of these same praise worship songs, right? When I was a pastor at a uni church, I was like, yeah, we got to get more singing. I talked for 20 minutes. It's so hilarious. It's an hour church service. I talked for 20 minutes. Maybe there was a 5-minute meditation. The rest of the time is singing.
Yeah.
So that's the power of song. So I think it is very deliberate that these folks, these Christian nationalist folks, are harnessing that as a way of trying to, you know, create solidarity, but also a sense of righteousness for the cause.
Yes, I think that's right. I think it's the emotional connection. It's the righteousness. It's the transcendent element. God approves of this. And hey, we're using God's name in vain. He's not striking us down for this. So God must be on board.
You know, sing out a key enough times, God will intervene. Because
there we go.
I've heard some praise and worship that was like, nope. Get in key, get on rhythm, clap on the 2 and 4, not on the 1 and 3. And yeah, but my best, if there's anything I miss from my growing up church experience, was the music element. I mean, I was part of the church band. Some sure. Sundays, I'm playing at 2 or 3 services. Like, we had such a great time because music is that powerful.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't know.
Mm.
That's all I got.
Mm, how great. I can't even say it. All right.
How great are we? How about that? How great are we? Is that too much?
Like, I was going to say it, but then I'm saying it like in a mocking way, and I don't want to do that because I don't want to say those words in a mocking fashion. But just see, you know, hearing a song like just sort of, you know, co-opted for ill intent, it just makes me sad.
I'm not saying it in a mocking fashion. I am great. Aren't you great? I'm okay to say.
No, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's reclaim our agency.
I hear you.
I think, you I know, and not keep turning it over to, you know, a belief system. I mean, because that's what we're turning it over to, right? We say we're turning it over to God.
Reclaim your agency. I like it.
Right. Reclaim the agency. There you go.
Like it. Well, thank you, friends, for tuning in to Pup Theology Live. You can show your love for the show by becoming a supporter on Patreon. Get access to pre- and post-show banter and more. Visit patreon.com/ptlive to get started. And, of course, a big thank you, as always, to our current patrons. Top cities tuning in this week, Sydney, Australia.
Woohoo! Australia is back.
They're back.
Come on, down under. Bring us under.
Let's go. Indianapolis, Indiana, and Columbus, Ohio. You can watch the video of these conversations on Facebook Live. And if you'd like to start a Pup Theology gathering in your town, find support and resources at puptheology.com. And until next time, friends, drink responsibly and keep those conversations flowing. All right, sir.
I will
be well.
You too as well. See you next week.
We'll chat soon. All right. See ya.